you're getting credit for a course so that you can get ultimately a diploma, a certificate, whatever it is your goal is here when you leave to be able to go on the job market.
What is that sneaky little saying that C's get degrees and D's get diplomas?
Welcome to the Pedagogy Toolkit. Today, Cammie and Amelie are talking about grading systems. So when you were growing up, did grades matter to you?
Yes, only because I felt like if I did not have an A or a B, that I was a bad child. Yeah. And I don't think my parent ever said that. It was just something that was generally in the culture. And also because I had an older sister who got A's and B's, and if I did less than her, then it would have been really bad.
Yeah, I remember being in second grade and getting a B on my report card in second grade and sobbing and sobbing. And my parents were so perplexed. They were going, why are you? It's fine. You're seven. You know, there was, they didn't. And for me, in my mind, I felt like this isn't, I'm never going to get to college. I'm never going to get anywhere.
Yeah. So I don't know what about grading gets into the culture like that, but it does. And as a kid, I didn't get as upset about it. I will say by the time I got to high school, though, I had very strict parents. And if I got a B on a 6-week grading report, which is what they had for their terms, were 6 weeks long, I was grounded for the next 6 weeks because that meant that I was not doing the job because they're like, oh, you're capable of getting A's, so you've got to, you know. And that was not the case in elementary. But when I got a B, man, and it was my world history class too, which is funny because I've ended up teaching that. Then it made me so mad.
My parents had no... There was no expectation. Like they were just, school was not a thing that mattered a lot to them. It wasn't, I mean, they had both gone to college. They were both educated. They just, it wasn't the end all be all for them. But for me, for whatever reason, I decided that was my only ticket out.
I will say at some point, I've just realized, I guess, that my entire adult life really realized that none of these A's mattered at all. None of the B's mattered. None of the C's mattered. It mattered that I progressed. And it did matter in terms of scholarship. Like I did end up getting scholarships. It was good.
Right.
But in terms of what I know and don't know, that's really been more about my exposure to those things, whether through people who knew about them or through my own experience of them.
Well, do you remember having a moment where you realized that the grades that you were getting or that your peers were getting or any of those things weren't necessarily matching what was happening? Like I remember one of my very good friends who always made terrible grades in school, but he made good enough to get to pass. He wanted to graduate from high school early, but he couldn't graduate from high school early because he was making such bad grades. So he dropped out and he went and got his GED. He passed the GED TABE tests with like a 95% on the first try. Those are hard. A lot of people who graduate high school would not pass the GED tests, weirdly enough. And when he came back, he only had one or two semesters left of school. And I was going, why are you doing this? You obviously can do the work. You're obviously smart. You're a smart guy. And he's going, I don't want to do it anymore. And it was one of those moments of like, no, it's not even just a difference between he's book smart or street smart.
Right.
He's also book smart. He just...
In school, of course, I knew there were people who were smart, who weren't making good grades, but it didn't necessarily connect with me. I just thought it was because they, you know, like they didn't care. But like the whole, it didn't connect with me that it was because they were uninterested or because it wasn't like the way school was built or being presented to them wasn't working for them.
Well, I think it perplexed me a lot, too, because obviously I was in this mindset that the grades that I made in school were going to dictate how my life went. And it obviously was not that way for everybody.
Right. Well, and that's a story that we tell a lot of times is these grades are what set you up for success. You go, you know, you get good grades, you go to college, and then you get a good job. Well, we've seen this pattern sometimes where maybe that isn't always what's matching up. Sometimes you get the good grades and you struggle in college, or you get the good grades, you go to college, but you can't quite find that job.
Well, and the other thing that I remember seeing when I started teaching related sort of to that was that we did a lot of work, project-based work, when I was working with high schoolers. We were not doing a lot of graded tests, and so there was very little emphasis on grades. And it gave some of the students some pretty serious anxiety because they were students who had made A's at their previous school, which was a very traditional high school or a traditional junior high. And then they got to us and they said, where's my multiple choice test? Where's my test? I need to know if I learned it. And I would have these long discussions with them, like, just because you made an A on it doesn't mean you learned it. And just because you made a D on it doesn't mean you didn't learn it. We got to get past this. That's not what happens in the real world. That's not what happens when you go to a job. That's not how this works. And they would just go, but I need a grade. I need to know what I learned. And it really got me thinking bigger too about why do we even grade? Where does this come from? How did we get to this? So I thought we could talk a little bit about sort of the history of grading and how we got there and kind of the problems and purpose. And then we can talk about some other ways that this can be approached that are different than what's traditionally done.
Well, you know I'm a fan of history and learning how we got places. So
there we go.
So Yale.
So Yale. Yale is really where it's considered to be the start of standardized grading. Basically, they just had a four-part grade buckets. they were it's basically a Latin, like best, good, not good, worst. Is basically what it amounted to. I'm not going to even pretend to pronounce the
You're
Latin.
You're the worst.
Yeah, basically. And it was all for ranking. It was to compare the students. It was exactly to compare the students to each other. It was, you are the best in this class. You are the worst in this class. It was very much about comparing them to their peers. And that was sort of the way that approached. So by that was the 1700s. By the 1830s, Harvard moves to that 100-point scale. But it treats it more like a bell curve, where bang average is about 50%, and it's clustered around that average. The highest 25%, the lowest 25%, those are rarer, but that middle 50% is really where the majority of students are going to fall. Somewhere along the line, K-12 jumps in and does just the ABCDF, basically the way we know it, as A being superior and F being failure and everything in between. But they approached it in a slightly more individual way of this is all about your growth as an individual student. It was less, you could have 10 A's in a class of 15 students. It didn't have to follow that bell curve because it was all about the individual growth of the students. And then again, at some point along the line, they attached that 100-point. They like meshed them together, the 100 points and the A through F. But now 75 became the midpoint. And now you have everything up to 59 is an F. You're completely lopsided in how much it skews to failure. And so it still leaves us without a lot of consistency. An A here may not mean an A there, and what would be a C in the in that original 100-point scale of a 50?
Right, was now a failure.
And is now, would be a 75 in this other scale. You've got all this translation that doesn't always come together. So there's a lot of problems with that. We already kind of touched on the one, that it's completely skewed to failure. You have 59 chances to fail. And only 10 chances to get an A.
Or 69 chances if you're in one of the schools who don't accept Ds.
Right. So you've got all these opportunities to get it wrong. And they all basically mean the same thing by saying that's an F. A 20 is a 30 is a 50. And I would say that a student learning 50% of the material is far different from learning 10% of the material.
Yeah.
Or learning it to 50% capacity or any of those.
And also, it's not necessarily about learning, but performance at that point.
Right. It doesn't necessarily, there isn't a good consistent connection between what that grade is and what it's supposed to be representing. It doesn't always translate to the real world. We mentioned that as well. I'm going to be having my yearly evaluation today. And I don't expect to be given grades like this. I mean, I am going to find out how I did. I am going to be evaluated. I am going to get a result. But it's about pinpointing performance. And we talked briefly, too, about motivation. It can be really demotivating for some students. For some students, not getting that A is the motivation. They want to work hard to get the A.
It was you. You were that student.
I was that student. That was me. But I also didn't have to work very hard for it. School came easy to me.
Yeah.
And for a lot of students, the fear of not being able to perform, knowing that they were going to get a bad grade, knowing they were going to be grounded, knowing they weren't going to be on the basketball team, knowing all of those things was enough to just go, well, I might as well not bother. And it had nothing to do with whether they had learned it or not. It also tends to be fairly backward-looking. A grade is evaluative of what you have done, not necessarily what you are doing.
Right. It's, I mean, when you give some kind of assessment, generally it's to evaluate what you have already learned, not what you are currently learning. And sometimes, and this is no slam to teachers because we all take a long time sometimes to grade things, but sometimes it just takes a while to grade because you have a lot of students and you know, sometimes you need to have bigger projects or it can't be a multiple choice because you're asking them critical thinking questions or whatever. But when it takes a while to get back to them, then it's not feedback they can implement immediately and grow from. They may continue doing something a way that you aren't looking for rather than not. So, yeah, it can be kind of hard.
So that kind of gets into the question of why do we grade then? What is our purpose as educators for grading?
Well, and I'll say so. What we're taught about grading and the importance of that, it's supposed to give students an idea of where they are so that they can grow, so that you can have that kind of conversation, but also a mark of did they learn this or did they not learn this. In terms of, especially in K-12 education, passing them to the next grade, I would say in higher ed, we're looking more at, did they attain the knowledge and skills necessary in this course to be able to, one, move forward in their program, but two, make them marketable in a job market.
So it sort of serves two purposes, the grading. It's, or multiple purposes, really. It's both about progress, but also about end result.
Now, one thing that we don't talk about very often with grades is from a teaching standpoint, that's also a moment when generally I look at grades and say, where did I miss in my lessons? What did I miss telling them? Where it's really obvious a lot of the students missed this one thing that I thought that, you know, should have been easy for them to pick up based on the lessons. Or what maybe should they have learned that I forgot to really include in that, or I didn't set it, not forgot, but didn't set up to include, you know, for next time. So there's a lot of different ways that you can use that data too, I think, to help inform your teaching. But is that, you know, is that always helpful necessarily for your students in that moment? You know, when you get a new batch of students, as we do every semester, you know, are they going to be a little bit different than the previous semester students?
And I think that is where a lot of instructors sort of forget to do that mirror check with the grades. because it worked so well with the last group of students, or the group before that got it just fine, this group isn't getting it for some reason. And remembering that these are different students that you have in front of you each time. But it also that also reminds me that there's that we can really kind of get into the difference between grading and assessing, that maybe it's worth thinking of grading as the final piece and assessing as what we do as we go along. That assess comes from the Latin for to sit beside. And so I like that as a reminder that for us as teachers, as instructors, that this is also, we have to look at ourselves and assess our own capabilities with that, with the students.
Yeah, I mean, learning is definitely something that instructors are facilitating with students.
So grading can be both proof of that learning happened, and it can be proof that there is progress happening. So there's kind of, that's treated as this proof of these events. But if that's why we're grading, are we always really conscious of what we're grading? As an instructor, when we start creating a class, start teaching a class, start building a class, do we think about what am I actually grading? What does this B represent?
I think with RSI, we've started to kind of look and in previous episodes, we've talked about regular and substantive interaction. That's what RSI stands for because no one wants to say regular and substantive interaction a whole bunch of times. So RSI is a federal policy guideline, if you will, that's really meant to influence the way that teachers who are in online courses are interacting with students. And one of those ways that they really focus on and is kind of like the whole underlying theme behind RSI is that assessment in terms of how students are learning, what they're producing, and giving that timely feedback so that students have time to incorporate that into their learning and grow during your class so that you can see that as the instructor. And I feel like that whole like underlying theme kind of really helps think through that grading system a little bit. It's brought it to mind a lot for me, and I've had a lot of interesting conversations with instructors about kind of what that means and what that looks like. Because we're all used to the regular online setup where you go in, you do your lesson, you may take a multiple choice quiz and you do a discussion board and, you know, you got two papers to turn in and whatever else. We all get tired of that, okay? So, but when you have things built into the online space where you are regularly getting feedback from someone who's an expert in the field, who knows what they're talking about, it makes such a huge difference. And can really grow your skill set. And so for me, I think that's really what the talk around grading has become, because now we're switching our brains from, hey, just assigning this grade, to what are we giving the students?
That's really, I hadn't really thought about this in terms of how RSI plays into it, but I think you're exactly right. It's sort of a trigger to get us to stop as instructors and think about what it is that we're actually handing these grades out for. What's behind it? What does that look like? Because one of the things that I was thinking about it with the what we grade is also the way that grades are almost used punitively sometimes.
Yeah.
Where almost everyone has a late policy for their work, and it usually, not always, but it usually involves deducting points, deducting letter grades, some other punitive piece that plays into the grade. So if we have a student who does an excellent paper that demonstrates all the skills you were wanting to teach them in that moment, or an excellent project that shows that they learned it to a T, but they turned it in late, what is that B, C, D, whatever they made on it, what is that actually representing? Is it representing their ability to do that skill? Or is it representing their executive functioning skills, their punctuality and organizational skills? I mean, what is it that we're actually, and if that is what you are specifically aiming to teach,
great.
Great. But that needs to be explicitly.
Right. It needs to be stated somewhere, including in the late policy, because I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to deduct late points. But stating explicitly, like, this is a skill. The reason we deduct late points is because sometimes it matters when you're on time. Now, not always, as the chair of my dissertation committee can attest to you. That is not my strength. But it does matter sometimes. You know, especially if you're in certain types of business fields, definitely the medical field. Like, I'm always grateful when my doctors and pharmacists are on time.
Well, yeah. Then I like to have that as a category in my rubric.
Right.
So that it is explicitly marked and that there is sort of a limit to where that can be factored into the complete grade. Or I take those skills and treat them as a separate grade altogether within the course. So I have a rubric for executive skills and a rubric for formatting, or a rubric for these things that are not necessarily what I am.
They're not the topic, but they are skills.
They
that
are still
you
things
want
that I want them to learn.
Exactly. Yeah. And that they need to abide. I mean, okay, we have a very diverse society these days, but there are still some things that are just common respect or kindness or courtesy, however you want to say it, within a society. And it's good to incorporate some of those things in your classroom.
It is so that standard operating procedures.
Yes. But that doesn't mean that you don't want to stop and say, hey, you're going to be evaluated on these. And I love the idea of a rubric in general. I love the idea of rubrics in general, just because I want to know what am I graded on?
Well, and I, again, back to what were you saying about RSI, I want to know as an instructor, I want to be sure that I am grading fairly, grading evenly, and grading with clarity.
Yeah. You don't want students to walk away from your feedback and go, they just said excellent and gave me an A, so I guess I have nothing to improve, right? There's never a time that you have nothing to improve, so let's be real honest about that, first of all.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like you, I recently had my evaluation, my annual evaluation, and I fully expected going in that everything I did is not going to be exceeds expectations,
right?
Because if that's the case, I'm just going to keep on doing the same things I'm doing and never improving, because that is how my brain works. Okay, exceeds expectations, then I am done here. Bye.
Done and done.
But we want to give our students more than that. And so being explicit and clear about not only what we're grading, but how students can improve in these areas are really important.
And I think we should probably also talk about the ways that, so if we're grading all of these different skills or these different events, these different projects, these different, you know, whatever we're grading throughout the course of a semester, and then we average those, I think we forget that that also muddies what we're grading.
Yes, definitely. Averaging can, but also I feel like weighting grades can be very confusing for students.
It can.
And so sometimes I think averaging makes more sense to their brains. But weighting is really a truer.
But also, I mean, you look at averaging. And so the example I was thinking of, if it takes me 14 tries to learn how to crochet, for example, if it takes 14 tries to get.
That sounds like a real life story.
I mean, it might be. But now I could do it in my sleep.
Right.
Does that negate where I got? So if I did it 15 times and the first 14 were garbage, but the 15th one, 16th one, and 17th one were perfect, I've learned it, right? I've learned it.
I would say yes. However, I do think there's a caveat to this, which is unlike me. because generally, I am that same way. I don't think it matters however many times it takes you to do it. You've learned it. But I do think that sometimes, for example, low-stakes quizzes after a reading, yes. That is not what I think of when I think of you should be doing that over and over again. You know, you get two tries and then you move on with your life because you should have read the material. But if you are talking about skills in writing a paper or analyzing complex information, that is a different type of assignment and skill.
Absolutely.
That we need to think of when we grade. And we need to approach these things differently. You know, a low-stakes quiz after your reading is to make sure that you read your stuff and that you can actually have a discussion about this. That is an accountability.
Yes, I think that's right. That's an accountability assessment. That's part of like assessing executive skills. That's a, did you do a thing? You did a thing. Check.
Yeah. But this is not about growing your critical thinking.
And I always hated the idea that even if I, so in that example, if I had 17 tries, the first 14 were terrible and I finally got it, if I averaged all those together, I'd still have a D.
Yeah.
Even if I got incrementally better each time, if I got better by, 5 points every time I did it, I got a 10% and then a 15 and then a 20 and a 25 and 30, I'm still, but then my last three are 100, 100, 100. And it's the same thing I'm doing. What's being measured? And I really appreciate the point that it's all about the purpose of that assessment. If it's a low stakes quiz for accountability purposes, then maybe we don't give unlimited tries on that. Maybe we don't allow students to replace with the highest scores.
But on something like that, and we are limited. We're limited to our semesters.
Yes.
For the most part. I know there are extenuating circumstances that sometimes lead us beyond our one semester. But in general, we are limited. And that's actually part of the evaluation that they don't tell you about when you come to the university, is that when you are in higher ed, the time you have to do that is the semester. As a student, you are not just graded on the work you're doing, but the work you're doing within that time frame. So even if, let's say, you take a class, your accounting class, you don't do so hot. Well, can you take that course again? Yes, but you can't just redo the one assignment for the most part. Because it's not just, the evaluation, the unspoken evaluation that is not in your rubric or anywhere else. Is that you're doing these things within a certain amount of time.
I do think exactly what you're saying. The point is we have to match the form to the function in the types of grading that we're doing, looking at what it is that we are assessing, what is the best way to assess that, what is the clearest way to communicate what we're assessing, how we're assessing it. So there are different systems. We are all familiar with the 100-point scale. We're all familiar with the A through F, and we're all familiar with the smush together 100-point scale with the A through F.
Or was it pass or fail?
Oh, right? Yeah, or
there's
pass
fail. There's the pass fail one.
Pass fail.
We had some of that during the pandemic.
Yeah, we did. So there are some different systems that are being put into place that are getting touted a little more, both at K-12 and at higher education, probably more so in higher education because there's a little more flexibility in some of the...
there's a little more autonomy.
Yes. So one of them is mastery-based.
I have to confess that I'm kind of a fan of mastery-based. When I was K-12 teaching, I would dream up my perfect school.
Yeah.
If I could build a school, what would it look like? And it's kind of really a blend of mastery and standards based a little bit, because the mastery is you have a certain standard, and if you get to that standard,
right,
you've mastered it, right? If you've mastered that standard, that's what the mastery is. And so I always, one of the biggest concerns with like gifted students or students who are struggling in school is that they, if they're held back, they're no longer with their age-based peers, or with gifted students, if they're moved forward, they are no longer with their age-based peers. And social development is very important. Like,
well, and in higher education, it's you're not with your cohort anymore if you've had to retake a class or if you're having to continue.
Right. And so, like, mastery, I feel like that overcomes that issue. You're not worried about being held back or having to retake a course or anything like that, or even advancing beyond your cohort, because you then have this, like, you're with your course, you're still working on those same skills, you keep working on those skills, and you keep doing it until you master it. Just like you said, like, you do it wrong 14 times on the 15th try, you've got it, and then you've got it down, and you
keep
having
it. But for the kid who got it the second time, they don't have to keep doing it 15 times
exactly.
Because you took 15 times. They get to keep moving on. But I also, that would be very cool, because then you can make sort of the grades that they are in, the classes that the class grade that they're in is almost the assessment of social skill. Because that is part of that's really what grouping students by age is about. Grouping them as social skills,
and at the higher ed level, you know, when in your cohort, it's really about creating those connections.
Yes,
I can't tell you how many professional connections have come because of my different educational programs that I've been involved in, and it really expands your network, I think, and really helps, just in general in the job market, but not. For the rest of your life, which sounds really crazy, but you know these people. These are the people who are going into your field. And then they meet people, and then you're introduced to new people because of them. And it goes on and on. And so it really helps you ultimately succeed to stay kind of with your cohort and build those connections and build the, oh my gosh, did you go through that class? Did you have that teacher? Can you believe that they asked us to do that? Do you remember, oh my gosh, staying up all night? You know, like it builds those just core connections.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that is and so we take mastery-based and we take standards-based, and those are, like you said, very similar. Standards-based is really looking at consistency across students, across courses, across programs, across institutions. That is almost every department on a campus has some sort of accrediting body that has standards that they have to prove that they meet, and that is part of maintaining their accreditation. That can also be applied to teaching our students.
Well, and the accreditation also has within it, part of your accreditation is that you have set outcomes for your students that you have proven that they are meeting these outcomes, that they have these outcomes when they leave your program.
And so that's some of the ways to implement those kinds of things. Those are harder to implement in a larger system, and those are hard to implement in finite time frames.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, mastery based, it's great because it gives people time to take their time to get where they need to be, but they have a semester to do it.
Right.
They don't get forever. This isn't your freshman decade.
So look, if the semester ends on your 14th try and 15 is around the corner, well,
yeah.
Sorry, Charlie.
So there are some limitations to doing things through mastery-based and standards-based. But you can do things like allowing students to make multiple attempts on those more skill-based assignments, allowing them to replace lower scores with scores that prove that they did master it. So instead of me having my 14 tries and 300s, I can replace all those 14 tries with 100s.
Right. Or just take the 100.
Yeah,
that shows that
exactly.
You did it. Yeah,
there's treating it as mastery versus in progress. It's mastered or it's in progress. It's not even failed. It's mastered in progress. So no, I mean, kind of as another way to to balance out the way a 100-point scale is so skewed towards failure. Never giving anything lower than a 50% for any attempt at all as a baseline. And I've had instructors try that out, and they felt like the end result, the students, they looked at all the grades of the students at the end of the semester and did kind of a overview of those grades and thought, Billy got a C. Did Billy's work overall, looking back on it holistically, was that C work? Absolutely. And they felt like it matched what they saw, what they expected to see. That's obviously not scientific. It is not super clear.
Well,
but I think we've all been teaching long enough to know that sometimes you get to the end of the semester and you're like, how did that kid get a B? Well, how'd he sneak that one in?
And I will say, and I've seen a teacher, actually, it was on Instagram. It was Brianna Richardson is her name. I want to say it's Honest Teacher Vibes.
Okay.
And she was actually just complaining about that same concept, because a lot of times in K-12, they are required.
They mandate it, yeah.
Yes, to do this. You cannot get a zero because zero is failure, right? And you're not allowed to do that to your students. But she said, when a student turns in nothing, and that to me is the difference. If a student is trying and they've tried something, why the zero? Let's give them something to push up, you know? But if they have done nothing, that is different.
Well, and that is the...
And the zero is a pain point, right?
The sort of the...
I don't know.
The big article that gets cited for this a lot is called The Case Against Zero, and I'll link it in the show notes. But they do talk about giving zeros even for nothing turned in, or giving 50% for nothing turned in. And on the one hand, it sticks all over me to be like, I'm going to give points to somebody who didn't do anything. But you know what? It's still a failure.
It is, but then,
They turn in 10 of those. It's not like I've given them anything. I gave them an F. I gave them Fs.
So we did have a policy like that in a school that I worked in, and they called it ZAP. And I don't remember what that stood for. I think it was some kind of acronym.
Love our acronyms.
I know. You know, there was SLANT. Because you had to sit up, listen tentatively, or I can't even remember all what they stood for. But that's what we had to tell our students, is to slant. And you know, I could not do that with a straight face. But ZAP, and I don't love it. But you're right; it is still a failure for them. It still is a pain point for them. And you know, we did talk about punitive things. I don't want things to be punitive, but at the same time, sometimes it takes a little pain to grow, and growing can hurt.
One of my problems with it, I think, is that it's still just a Band-Aid for what you've basically admitted is a broken grading system. If you're going to this system of no zeros, you've basically admitted that the way you've been grading is broken. And so you're just band-aiding it. It's because you don't want a zero to completely tank a kid's grade or a student's grade, a young adult's grade. You don't want a zero to completely tank their grade. So you give them the 50% and it still gives them the F, but it doesn't get. But then don't average. Look at some of these other things. If that's not the purpose that fits what you're trying to teach, then maybe that's not the grading system that you would need. Maybe it's looking at doing a standards-based grading on a 5-point scale that tracks to A, B, C, D, F, period.
Okay, but if in your class you have outcomes that you've listed for your course, who has met those outcomes? Is it every student in your course? Is it every student who gets an A in your course? Is it every student who passes your course? How do you know? And the answer, of course, is those who pass. However, is the kid who made the 70, you know, that's 70% mastery of these outcomes, the same as the one who has a 95% mastery of these outcomes? And right now that answer is yes, because they both pass the course and get the credit for it, right? But, and no one else said that. That's just me saying
right.
Yes. That's just my brain. But it, this kind of, like, that kind of thought process really makes me curious, because how do we distinguish or define this? And does it matter? You know, we talked about earlier how we realized, like, the A's that we got didn't matter. The people who were, you know, making the 70s, or like your friend who dropped out of high school and got his GED and did really well, that happens. And is it ultimately stopping success? We do know that, you know, for those students who maybe make C's in high school, sometimes they do a little better in college because they're used to studying than the students who make
That's
A's.
True.
Not always, but, you know, we've seen it enough that
yep.
That's a kind of what you expect. But when you're at the university level, it's very different. But you're getting credit for a course so that you can get ultimately a diploma, a certificate, whatever it is your goal is here when you leave, to be able to go on the job market.
What is that sneaky little saying that C's get degrees and D's get diplomas?
That's what I'm saying.
Like, exactly. That's what you're saying. C's get degrees.
Yeah. They, and so
my degree is a C. Well, in some countries they have degrees of degree.
Oh yeah. Right. But who is, like, also, is it mattering in the workforce? So, like, when that A student gets to the workforce and they are, you know, using their skills, hopefully, that
right.
they've attained at university.
That they've mastered.
Right. They should
have. Up to standard.
The 95% mastery, are they as effective, or I should say, is a 76% mastery as effective as the 95% mastery once they get out? And if so, why are we even distinguishing?
Right.
So that's my other big question, I guess, with grading systems is, where are we going with this?
But I think that's exactly the question that we have to be asking every time we're working on a course, every time we're working on a program, every time anybody who has the ability to make those decisions, because everything needs to be, we need to match form to function when we're doing these things. We're not you and me sitting here going to overhaul higher education.
What?
And how,
that
I know,
is why we have
I'm
these
sorry,
conversations,
that's,
man.
That's why I brought you here today, Cammie, to tell you that we are not changing, single-handedly changing higher education.
You have just crushed my dreams.
But the more that we can match what is being assessed, how we are assessing it, how we are communicating that, and whether that matches up with what we say we're doing, because I think that's what got me so much growing up seeing grades, is it wasn't representative of what they said it was.
Well, and that's okay. So everything I just said, that is kind of like my question. And I see instructors who also kind of believe the same thing, you know, like the whole grades don't matter uh-huh. kind of vibe. And that's not what I'm saying here, people. But there are instructors.
I do know instructors who say, I don't want to grade at all, period.
Yes. But also they say, you know, like if their students pass the course, they all get A's. If they fail the course, they get F's. There's no other mm-hmm. in between. It's kind of a pass-fail, but they just use the letters to pass or fail. And so if you have done the work to an acceptable rate, you get the A. And you see this a lot more, I think, in graduate school than undergrad, because undergrad, you know, one for the traditional undergraduate, I should say, you know, they're coming straight from high school and that's the system that makes sense to
them.
There's
a translation that needs to happen before.
Right. There's a translation and there is a prefrontal cortex development that needs to happen before some of these things.
Yeah. They're still marinating.
Yes. Yes. Well, it makes a difference to them.
Absolutely.
And so I don't understand, I guess. I do want to know if there's a way that I can improve. But I don't really care that much about grades anymore, I've noticed.
Right.
I've also just gotten really fine with whatever is happening because I've realized that a lot of times it's also situational. And I've seen this both as a teacher in my students. You can have a really great student who knows a lot, but their grandma died and they are not dealing with things well right now because they are grieving. And that's okay. You know, they missed an assignment. That happened. Actually, it happened to me when my mom died. I made a D on my midterm, and we only had a midterm and a final in there. And so I ended up with a C in the class.
And that's, you know, that averaging.
And I said, a D on the midterm, an A on the final, a C. That's what that is. But it was okay. I was fine with that because I knew exactly why that happened. And so it just becomes a thing where, okay, but are we grading their knowledge? Are we grading their situation as well? And so it's like a whole other factor.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No.
Sorry, I'm talking about all of this. But
no, but it
just makes me think of it.
It is something that I think about all the time with our students. How is this being represented outside as well? Like you said, so you made a C in that class. If somebody looks at that and they say, so she has C-level knowledge of that concept? Not necessarily. There's so much that goes into and thinking about what we want our grades to actually represent.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things that was ever said to me by the first professor that was sort of my teaching mentor, who after my first semester teaching a college course, he and I sat down and he looked at my grade book, an old-fashioned grade book, the green grade book.
Yes, I remember those. I had one.
We looked through it, and my class had a lot of A's and a good number of B's and not a lot of failures. And I was nervous because I thought, this isn't a bell curve. This is definitely not a bell curve. They did way too well here. And I went back and looked at a bunch of their essays and their assignments and their work rate and all of those things. And they got A's. The students all got A's. They got A's and B's. That was their they were the right grade. And when he looked at it, he said, you got a lot of A's and B's here. I said, yeah, I do. And I looked at them and I went back and I didn't. He said, well, don't discount the fact that you might have taught them something.
Right.
And that alone has stuck with me. These grades have nothing to do with a bell curve. They're what have I taught them or what have they learned? It's not even about what have I taught them. It's what have they learned.
Well, I mean, it is both because, again, like we talked about earlier,
yeah,
you do want that reflective piece in terms of evaluating yourself through student grades. But yeah, what are they learning? It's about their individual learning and not a bell curve that we're making up. I did have an administrator that I worked under for a while, probably the best administrator I've ever worked under, but he was a bell curve person. But I don't think it's always like 10% are your A's, 15%
right,
are your B's, you know, another 50% are going to be C's or whatever. Because students do grow and learn, and it's possible for them to do that in a class. It's possible for them because, again, what we're measuring is behavior in grades because we can't actually open up their little brains and go, what did you learn? And see, like, you know, the level increase, right? We can just tell by their behavior and what they're producing for us. So did they produce this with the analysis of the content that I wanted in a format that I asked them to use? You know, are they doing these things? That's what I can measure.
And like he said, it might also mean that you taught them something.
Right.
It also discounts for teachers. It can be kind of insulting if you say, why do you have so many high grades?
Well, because
I'm a good teacher.
My gosh.
But we're kind of quick to just assume that the students must fall into the bell curve. They must be falling into this. There can't be that many A's. I'm also, like I said, I'm not someone who gives hundreds. That still doesn't mean that they don't do A work or they don't make, you know, get skills up to a level that I would consider mastery, whether that's 80%, 90%.
And that's very different. And here's the other thing. Even with a 100 grade, is there feedback that you could give them? Absolutely.
There's always feedback.
Because there's also always a next step.
Mm-hmm.
You never get to the end and you're just like, oh, I've completed all the things.
I'm done now.
Because learning is always a progressive movement. There's never a time when you stop. Or I hope there's never a time when you stop.
But yeah, I think so we don't have a solution for how to make grades super, super effective. And, you know, we know a few different systems.
We know some systems. But also, here are the tricks, I think, that we've talked about. Here are the tricks, grading. We've solved it all. I'm just kidding. We have not. But some things that you can do is ask, why are you grading that to begin with? Ask, is what you're grading clear to students? And is the feedback, you know, are you giving them feedback that they can actually implement in whatever they are using next? How are you building their skills through this grading and feedback assessment as we sit beside our students and push them forward?
Thank you for joining us on the Pedagogy Toolkit. Don't forget to subscribe.